This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Topher, Principal Architect of Topher Architecture, and you are listening to New Books Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network dedicated to architecture and its publications. If you have any suggestions on authors you'd love to hear me speak with next, feel free to send me an email at btopher@topherarchitecture.com. Today's guest is Anne Marie Boris to talk about her book, American Unitarian Churches, Architecture of a Democratic Religion. Anne is an associate professor of architecture at the University of Washington. And Anne, thank you so much for being here with me today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Of course. Now, before we begin, can you tell the audience a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. I studied architecture first as an undergraduate and went on to work in the profession for about 7 or 8 years, getting licensed along the way, and decided to go get a master's degree with Syracuse University in Florence. After spending a year in Italy, I went on to the doctoral program at the University of Pennsylvania. The opportunity came to begin teaching full-time at the University of Cincinnati. And now I've been teaching here at the University of Washington for about 12 years.
So now that we're jumping right in, I guess I'll keep on this train here of personal questions. So what drew you to do so much research and visit so many Unitarian churches?
The primary thing that got me started, although several things kind of converged, the primary thing was that I was rereading some of the scholarship on Wright's Unity Temple and Lou Kahn's First Unitarian Church in Architecture for my course that I was teaching at the time. And I felt there wasn't much context given for claims that they were unique compared to either what came before or that they became a model for what came after. So I went looking for some information on Unitarian churches a little bit more broadly, and I couldn't find any, which set off a little bell. Around the same time, though, I had already been thinking about some similarities between two churches I knew firsthand, one that had been around the corner from where I lived in Cincinnati and one here in Seattle. They were both pretty striking and had some similarities. And they were both done by regionally successful architects. I thought I might write a paper, to submit for a conference about them. And I went online to try to find a third because I thought, three is always a good number. And one was in wood and one was in steel. So I thought I might find one in concrete. And I did. It was the First Unitarian Church of Arlington, Virginia. And so I did write a paper comparing those, the sort of structural expressionism of those churches. Mm-hmm. But in looking for that example, I also found a lot of other innovative churches from the 50s and 60s. And so once I kind of stumbled on this cache of interesting buildings, I started to look at the history of Unitarianism because I really didn't know much about it, and to find what I could on their churches of the 19th century, because that would be what came before Wright's Unity Temple. That hunch seemed to just play out And I went a lot deeper than I ever expected to go.
And so I do want to circle back to, you know, the history of the church that you talked about. However, so you mentioned Frank Lloyd Wright, and I think most architects, those studying architecture, you know, I think most know Frank Lloyd Wright, and I also think most of them are aware of his ties to Unitarianism. I guess I know I personally was not aware of how many other architects and how many of them are involved. And so again, I know that's a big question, but could you talk a little bit more about some of these other architects? You already mentioned Louis Kahn, who I was not familiar with being involved. I mean, I guess what other architects were involved in this that I don't think most of us are aware of?
Sure. One of the things that I was, discovering slowly as the story was unfolding is that, in fact, there's a kind of a through line of excellence in American architecture in telling the story of Unitarian churches. The very first ones were by Charles Bulfinch, who, uh-huh. Did the Massachusetts State House, was one of the architects for the U.S. Capitol building, one of the first professional architects in this country, in fact, and he was a Unitarian. And so he did quite a few Unitarian churches in Boston and New England, and then also did the first one in Washington, D.C. when he moved there to work on the U.S. Capitol building. Uh-huh. Post-Civil War, there were works by Richardson and Furness. Frank Furness was actually the son of a Unitarian minister. And so both Richardson and Furness had their very first commissions as solo architects from Unitarian congregations. Just an interesting little connection there. And around that time, there were some other unusual examples in New York and Boston, but the architects are not as well known. But then, towards the end of the 19th century, there were works in the Bay Area by Bernard Maybeck and Albert Schweinfurth, who were among the arts and crafts architects of that region. And let's see, the other one that I would mention in the sort of more distant past, right around 1900, was a church for Evanston, Illinois, by Marion Mahoney Griffin, while she was working in Frank Lloyd Wright's Oak Park studio. So unusual to have one by a woman. And she designed it before Wright had started his designs for Unity Temple.
Interesting. I'm sorry.
Oh, so did you want the 20th century, the list?
Of course.
I can just give you a quick list there.
Of course.
We've got Pietro Belucci, Victor Lundy, Edward Durrell Stone, Ulrich Franzen, Paul Rudolph, and William Worcester is a good short list.
And so you mentioned Edward Durrell Stone. And, it's interesting. I lived in Schenectady, New York for years, very close to this church, and was not aware of it, did not know it was a Unitarian church. And so, again, going through the book, it's very interesting to see some of that. And so, again, I can't speak for everyone, but I think a lot of us, because we're not aware of all the other architects besides Frank Lloyd Wright, some of these other churches, as well-known or not, a lot of other religions, I think there's usually a similar design language between churches. For the Unitarian churches, would you say that there's a common design tying them together, or are they all truly one-off projects?
There was some conformity in various periods, especially, in the 19th century, many of the urban churches were just following the general trends in church design. So you get the 19th century revival styles, essentially. But there were always a few outliers that tried something really different. And then into the 20th century, when we get into the post-World War II works, they're really all quite different. Each congregation wanted something of a self-portrait for their congregation through the architectural expression of their church. And of course, the mid-century modern architects were all really exploring for a personal style by which to update modernism of the international style. Mm-hmm. There was much more variety that was going on, and I think each individual architect was trained to think of themselves as the artist architect and looking for their own vocabulary of form and material. So they all do look quite different.
And so, you know, I guess in my opinion, it does seem like of all the different, you know, religions, there does seem to be a bit of a draw of a lot of architects to do in a Unitarian church. Would you think it's because of that freedom to explore it to their own heart's content?
I think very much so. I think that the congregations were always interested in being up to date or innovative. They're right. Not interested in tradition. They're not interested in looking backwards. They're very progressive and they're very forward looking. So they invited architects, you know, that they expected to be, you know, innovative and experimental. They didn't want something exotic for right. the most part, but they weren't afraid of being something a little different. One of the funny things about exploring some of the churches is they had a lot of funny nicknames by people around them because right? they were not your average church. And so they got their reputation that way.
And so you kind of talked about a few characteristics of the congregation. And so, you know, I'm familiar with Unitarian religion because of Franklin Wright and some of his churches, but I personally, before reading this, I'll pretend like I didn't read it, was not aware of kind of some of the main tenets of the religion itself. And so I'm wondering if you could maybe elaborate on that for some of our listeners who have probably heard about it or aware of some of the buildings, but probably don't know much about why this religion is a little separated from the rest.
Sure. It actually had its roots right around the same time as the American Revolution and the one or two decades following that. And it was basically the product of a split in the Congregationalists, the New England Congregationalists, who were descendants of the Puritans, essentially. Hmm. And so this split occurred between the mainstream or conservative branch who wanted to reestablish their roots to their sort of Puritan ideologies and the more liberal branch that was interested in going a different way. And I think that the easiest way to it's a little bit of a caricature or, you know, but to just say that the Congregationalists were very much in belief of original sin and the depravity of man and what you had to do for salvation in the afterlife. The Unitarians were very much about the dignity of man and that the sign of God was in his creation as man. Or humans, I should say.
Right.
Although the literature that you're reading to understand these things is all from, you know, a time when they would call it man.
Right.
So that was the split of the ways, and Unitarianism was a leading cultural force throughout the 19th century in America. It was not as strict a kind of a form of Protestantism as the rest.
Interesting.
In the 19th century. And then it was at the end of the 19th century that things evolved to the point where they really started having a strong contingent of atheism within the denomination.
Is that right?
And in the 20th century, they were very involved with the formation of the first Humanist Manifesto in the 1930s. And while everyone in a Unitarian congregation then and today is expected to decide for themselves of their own belief system, there is no single belief one has to hold to be a Unitarian.
And you mentioned
join a congregation.
And towards the end of the book, you do mention that it does have a real strong focus on citizen participation. Hopefully I didn't butcher your quote there. And you mentioned, you know, Louis Sullivan actually really, along with many of the architects, really do push that idea of instead of decisions coming on from up high, it's more down to the individual. I mean, would that be accurate?
Yes, I would say so. Yeah.
And so that actually, and I that leads me to another question I was having. And so I guess, and again, this is a very vague question, but, you know, the book, of course, is very in depth about the past and the history of Unitarianism. I guess the question is, you know, is the Unitarian movement, I mean, is that still around? Is it still as active or strong as it was?
Yes, absolutely. It is. Well, not as strong as it was in the 19th century.
Right.
I should say that for sure. But as strong as it has been in the 20th century, there were a couple of times when things kind of trended a little downward, which the 70s, right after the period I ended about 1970. There was a sort of a downturn, but that had to do with a lot of the social change going on in the country anyway.
Interesting.
But there was a resurgence back up to about the 1960 level in the 90s and early aughts. So as far as my research had it, they were still about as strong as that. That said, it's still like less than 1% of the country.
Oh, really?
So it's a very small, you know, numerically, but it has a large cultural throw weight,
right?
Even, you know, throughout the 20th century. I don't know that it still does today, but definitely throughout the 20th century.
Well, it's interesting to hear that smaller percentage than I would have imagined. Yeah. And so, of course, those listening can't see all the great graphics and drawings. But so, of course, we've covered, you know, there is quite a bit of difference. You know, the churches really are standalone and they don't resemble the traditional church. However, you know, in all your research, would you say that there are some similarities or cues from traditional church architecture that does seem to show up in buildings, or is it truly a complete separation from that?
I think there's not really anything coming from a traditional church so much. And I think that's one reason the architects of the 20th century were so drawn to the commissions.
Right.
Because it really gave them a chance, instead of to be sort of problem solvers, to be more of a problem setter in the sense of what is a church that has, for a religion that has no symbols,
right,
no rituals, no agreed upon belief system or creed. Those are things we usually, you know, dig into for design to, you know, embody with architectural design. And so it was that sort of blank slate that I think was probably very appealing.
Agreed. And so, again, the book does a great job with a lot of case studies, and sadly, we just wouldn't be able to cover them all without staying here all day. But, you know, after your in-depth research, is there two or three specific churches that have a special place in your heart? And maybe can you tell us why that is? Or their significance overall?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I think the one that jumps to mind first and foremost is actually one by an architect who is not well known. He died young, but it was from the 1890s in Berkeley. And it was for the first, you know, it was called First Unitarian Church of Berkeley. And Bernard Maybeck was actually a member of the church, but he wasn't commissioned for it because he was, when they finally had the funds together to build, he was in Europe at the time looking at things for inspiration because he had been hired to do the Berkeley campus already. So Schweinfurth had worked with Maybeck on some projects and was on his own, and he got the commission. And it was, you know, the nickname was it the Church of the Power Plant, although I'm not sure I really see why somebody called it a power plant, but it really caught the spirit of the arts and crafts in the Bay Area, and used cedar shingles and had two giant redwood logs for columns on the corners of the porches on each side. It's still standing. It was sold to the campus when the congregation moved up the hill in early 1960s, and has been a dance studio for the Berkeley campus. So I think it really shows this rawness of some of the design work. It was the first one to use steel casement windows, for instance. And actually Maybeck designed, about 7 years later, Maybeck designed a secondary building to work to be the social hall. And unfortunately, the campus tore that down when they acquired the property. But it was quite compelling design.
Oh, that's a great explanation. So
that would be my first. and then Furness's first Unitarian Church of Philadelphia is just kind of a wild thing. It's in the middle of, it's from 1883, and it's so mid-Victorian era. There's no style you could actually call it. That's actually one thing that again ties Richardson and Furness together, is they were among those architects that we look to say first successfully broke away from derivative work of Europe. And the church was for his father's congregation. His father had retired at the time, but he was hired for the church they needed when they were in a period of growth. And it is just full of all kinds of quirky details that introduce a lot of natural themes that he designed for himself. And one of the great features is that it has this long, low, arcaded porch on the front facing Chestnut Street. And the last bay over was a library, so that you could go into the library and borrow a book if you didn't really want to go sit in the service. There's always this thing about Unitarian churches is you have a choice.
Right.
There's no sort of compulsion to get in there, get in the doors. So I love that there's a library on your way to church.
Great explanations. Thank you so much. And so again, like I said, we could cover every church and be here for a while. But so now that the book has, you know, been finished and completed, I guess now what is the next thing taking up your time? You know, what's the next project in the future?
Well, I haven't really committed yet to like something. Okay. I would quite call the level of a project, but you know, I am exploring a few things that did arise from this work. I'm currently writing a short paper that I'll be presenting in June to the Architecture, Culture, and Spirituality Forum Symposium. It's actually going to take place at Falling Water.
Interesting.
And the paper is digs into some of the creative processes in which the mid-century Unitarian churches were produced. I'm also continuing to read biographies from some 19th century figures that caught my attention. I was just really fascinated by the work I did looking at the 19th century for this book. One of the things I'm reading is about Margaret Fuller, who many people would recognize among the Transcendentalists, but probably don't know she's one of her descendants was Buckminster Fuller.
I did not know that.
And and his middle name, Buckminster, was another Unitarian minister in Boston in the 1830s, Joseph Buckminster. So there's just all these funny connections there.
Yeah.
And at any rate, and then I'm also really interested in exploring the potential for architecture to express democratic values a lot further. I take that up in the last chapter of the book, and I think found a clear enough case that's what these congregations were asking for from their architects, something that would express their belief in democracy and their adherence to using democratic processes for all community or congregational business. But I'd like to expand on that a little bit past these communities and think about the political dimensions of spatial relations as they're now being called into critique with unarticulated inherent imbalances of power are now being brought to the fore. I would like to follow the chain of democratic expressions of space a little further.
Those are some big subjects. Can't wait to hear about any of them. Well, I want to thank you again for taking the time to talk with me today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Same here. And for everyone listening, the book is American Unitarian Church's Architecture of a Democratic Religion. Thank you very much for listening and have a great day.